Welcome to the Fundamental Health Podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Paul Saladino. This podcast is the result of my relentless search to understand and correct the roots of chronic disease and illness. In this podcast, I will share with you everything I have learned about how to live the most healthy and radical life possible. Thanks for joining me on this journey. What is up, you guys? Every once in a while, I have the good fortune of having so many awesome podcast episodes that I cannot release them all once a week. And so I do these bonus episodes. So lucky you all, welcome to the bonus round. This is the bonus episode of Fundamental Health. It is brought to you by my book, The Carnivore Code. I so hope you guys will check this out if you have not already. TheCarnivoreCodeBook.com. It's on Amazon. It's on Barnes & Noble. You can get it everywhere. The ebooks are out now. The print books are out now for pre-order. If you pre-order, I will be announcing a link later this week. I'll release it in my newsletter, which comes out on Sunday. You can go to carnivoremd.com to sign up for my newsletter, but I will distribute a link by which you can get access to a private video. It's a 20-minute video I recorded, how to like start the carnivore diet, right? And everybody that pre-orders, I will give you access to a live Q&A with me after the book releases formally on August the 4th. The audiobook will be uploaded in the next week or so, so you should be able to pre-order that. But I am super excited to be releasing the second edition of my book, The Carnivore Code, in early August. And I'm just excited for this message of animal-based eating, which I believe will help so many people and will dispel so many of these incorrect myths, lies, untruths, misleading propaganda that are out there. It'll challenge them head on to get much more widely distributed. This book is going to rock the boat in a big way, as it already has, and I'm super stoked about that. So please check it out. Thank you for your support. www.thecarnivorecodebook.com. If you appreciate this podcast, please leave me a review on iTunes. Thank you so much for your support. If you have read the book, please leave me a review on Amazon. It helps. We've got over 500 reviews with a 5-star average of the book right now, which crushes it for a book that was self-published and only released in February of this past year. Definitely Amazon bestseller. Can't wait for it to be New York Times and Wall Street Journal bestseller. Tell your mom, tell your sister, tell your grandma, tell your brother, tell your kids. Get the word out. This will help a lot of people. Thank you all for your support. So on the podcast this week, have my friend Anya Fernald. She is the CEO of Belcampo Farms. You guys know them. They have sponsored the podcast in the past. This is not a sponsored episode. I didn't receive any money for this episode with Anya. I just appreciate her, her story, where she's come from, and how she has a perspective on Belcampo. You'll learn all about that farm, how they're doing things, how it's different than other farms. It's a great follow-up to the episode I did earlier this week with Rob Wolf and Diana Rogers. They were talking about the ideas, and now Anya is a real-life farmer woman. She's the queen of regenerative ag in Northern California, as I say. That's my designation for her, but I think she's pretty rad. And we even talk about how to cook organ meats. She gives us some of her recipes. We talk about what it's like to be eating meat as a woman and all kinds of other good stuff like that. We talk about chicken, what they're feeding the chickens, chicken life cycles, cow life cycles. I learned a lot in this podcast. It's really cool to hear about it from someone who is really pushing this in the right direction and in charge of this 30,000 acre farm that is doing things in a regenerative organic fashion in Northern California by Shasta. On the YouTube that accompanies this, there are lots of, I did screenshot or I pulled in some images from their website. It's a pretty beautiful farm. Check it out. You can use the code CarnivoreMD at Belcampo to get 20% off your awesome meat. As I say in this video, I've been digging stew meat. I love the cheaper cuts now. I cook them in bone broth. You can get a pretty darn good deal on them right now. Belcampo also has amazing ribeyes in New York. It's probably some of the best I've ever had in my whole life. And as Anya says in this video, mostly because of me and you guys and my listeners, they're offering more and more organ meats. They're offering suet, which is a great source of stearic acid. You know, I've been talking about this a ton recently. So get your suet, get your organs, get your meat. Check it out at Belcampo. Support this project. This is how we protect the earth. This is good for the soils. All right, guys, on to the podcast. Listen after for what is going on with me, and I appreciate you all. Anya, thanks for coming on the podcast. Good to see you.
Likewise. Thank you for having me.
Yeah, so people may or may not know this, but when I was living in California, I had some of the best meals of my life at Belcampo in Los Angeles, and a few of those I was fortunate enough to have them cooked by you specifically, and which was amazing, with some other really good company, our mutual friends and stuff. It was great. But if people have not been to Bel Campo in Los Angeles or San Francisco or New York, I would highly recommend that. But I'm so excited to have you on the show, because during those dinners, you and I began these conversations. And as I've learned more and more about what you're doing with Bel Campo, I'm just super excited to share this with my audience. Earlier this week, I had Rob Wolf and Diana Rogers on the show talking about their book, Sacred Cow. So this podcast is a real kind of natural progression to actually talk to someone that's on the ground in this regenerative movement. So let's just dive right in. I mean, what's your story? How did you're a chef too, right? So like, tell me your story. How did you get into this? How did you become sort of the queen of regenerative agriculture in Northern California?
So, you know, I come at this from a place of just personal health. So my journey into the business I run now really came from initially personally trying to get myself very high quality meat. I eat a mostly meat diet. I thrive on a high protein diet. I had lived in Europe for many years and worked in animal agriculture, and I developed a real taste for, you know, just very kind of like not your diet exactly, but just, you know, I like to eat whole foods. I like to eat a lot of meat. And when I moved back to the United States after living abroad for 7 years, I really struggled physically with the quality of the meat that I could buy. And I had what I would now call just a very strong inflammatory response to the meats that I could source easily here in Northern California. And it struck me as odd, because in Northern California, it's like bountiful. You know, we have all these organic vegetables. We've got all this really high quality dairy. So where the hell's the meat? You know, this is back in 2005, 2006. So I started buying my own whole animals and whole pigs and cows at the time, and distributing them among friends. And, you know, I've been an entrepreneur in the food space. And I, you know, at the time was running a produce company. And because of that, I had, you know, access to refrigerated vehicles, because I knew a lot of farmers, I worked in the industry, so I was able to kind of make this happen. But it struck me that it's enormously challenging for somebody concerned about their health who wants premium, high quality, source verified meat that is not going to be inflammatory to find it. So the landscape's improved since then, in part because of what we've done with Bel Campo. But I started the company in 2012. My business partner, who was coming at it from a different angle, he was interested in sustainability through conservation. And so putting land into regenerative uses in California. So between, you know, the two of us started working together actually in 2010. And at the time I'd taken a pause from, you know, after selling my last business, and I was a consultant for a few years to figure out what I wanted to do next. And I got the chance to start a beet business, and it aligned, you know, for myself personally, the change I want to be in the world. And then, you know, really I've always worked in animal agriculture because I love animals and because I'm interested in animals and animal health and those kind of things. So it's just it's a convergence of a lot of my passions.
And what were you doing in Europe for those years before you came back to the States? Were you doing culinary stuff?
I started out working as a cheesemaker. Uh-huh. And then I basically did a microfinance program for small scale food entrepreneurs. Uh-huh. Throughout Europe. And but I'd gotten into, you know, culinary chefing, that I looked at it early in my career. That was sort of the path that I was pushed towards, especially, you know, as a young woman in the late 90s interested in food. It's like, well, you could be a journalist or you could be a cook. And I'm like, no, thank you. No, thank you. You know, I'm just not particularly interested in, I mean, most kind of like fine dining is just, it's like a fancy processed food. It's not particularly interesting to me. A lot of stuff is blended and, you know, and lots of stabilizers, lots of gums and stuff in it. And I just wasn't interested in jumping for that ring. It just never really intrigued me. Now, I spent years as a judge on Iron Chef America. I've done lots of, I run restaurants. So it's not exactly like diplomatic for me to say that point of view, but I think of most fine dining as processed food. I don't think it's appealing. I don't think it contributes to health. I think that the culinary world has a really misguided kind of positivity around really poor health outcomes and doesn't take responsibility for health. And so I really have actively disassociated myself from my kind of culinary world, because I just don't really want to play. I think that part of the reason that we're all obese and sick and inflamed in this country is because our culinary icons are obese and sick and inflamed. And I think we need to take responsibility as people promoting food to promote good food. And doesn't mean health food, but it means natural food that looks like food. You know, I'm just saying, I'm not going to advocate for anybody ever eating a fried pickle. Just think it's stupid. And so I sort of stepped aside from that world as part of my own growth, you know? So, but if you look at the great kind of culinarians of the world, it really typically is about high quality, good ingredients, many of them animal based, right? In the US, we have become disassociated. And actually my brand, Belcampo, I initially really marketed to a culinary community. I mean, initially was trying to get chefs and folks really stoked about the product. And what I realized is there wasn't as much attention to ingredients as I would like. And so I personally love health and wellness and was like, wow, I feel like that's more my people. And I felt like there was more interest actually in where stuff came from in the health world than there ever has been for me in culinary.
That's so interesting. And I have to agree with you 100%. People always ask me, do you go to restaurants? And I say no, because what's the point in going to a restaurant, as you say, when the majority of fine dining is just processed food? It's just dressed up sort of, you know, fake processed food with stabilizers and gums and other things that make it unhealthy. And you put such a good pin on this, that our culinary icons are essentially all fat and unhealthy and inflamed. And I don't really watch the Food Network. I've seen some of them, but you really highlight that I've noticed that, yes, they're all pretty unhealthy and they don't look very good. And it's like, why are those our icons?
It's almost like a point of pride. You know, it's a point of pride. And I picked up on that really early. I remember my first job in culinary. I was a short order cook and I was working in the peninsula in California. And the gentleman that I work with was a veteran of the industry and he got there every day and drank a Coke and smoked a cigarette at 6 a.m. And I remember just thinking then, I'm like, I'm not sure this is where I want to roll. like I was like biking there and I was just like, I'm into food, but I'm also into, you know, that I'm into food because it makes me feel great, you know? And then as I progressed and got more and more exposure, it's like, I go to these fancy food events and these big, gatherings. And it's like, it's all, you know, it's rampant alcoholism and substance abuse. It's overeating. It's emotional eating. And it's like a point of pride to be physically, you know, kind of a dumpster fire. And I just, to me, it's like, and I also think if you don't treat your body like that, you're almost like, like nobody trusts the fat chef. You know, you're like, well, it's like there's a lack of a balance in it. And I'd say, you know, Lord, there's plenty of that in the fitness industry as well, you know, of like lack of balance and dysmorphia and confusion. So it's like, there's always extremes, but I find that the way that the sort of the overweight, overindulgent, childish culinarian, you know, where we're like encouraged to have these childish tastes throughout our lives and only eat breaded food and everything's fried. And it's like, I just don't want to play. It's just not my scene. And I think, and I do think it's like, it's irresponsible. I also think now looking at COVID and obesity in the US, it's like, hey, culinary world, why isn't anybody raising their hand saying, you know, hey, I'm going to lose 15 pounds. I challenge my community to in the culinary world, given the correlation that we've seen with the obesity and the comorbidities. So I think that the interest for me in food comes from an interest in loving to cook and loving that the art of preparation and the support that I can give to my family and my community. I love taking care of people. I'm very like domestic and love taking care of my home. So a lot of it's just personally gratifying. And then the other piece of it is like, I love feeling great. I love every day being awesome, you know, and that to me, the best way to control that is through eating really great food, right? And the second is like movement and light and all those other things. So for me, it's like that's where the passion came from. And then once you start to noodle on that, you kind of land on meat as this big problem and opportunity area that people haven't really figured out, you know, how to source good stuff.
And those two don't have to be mutually exclusive. It's, you don't have to have healthy food taste badly, and you can easily make food that is very nutritive and very enriching to human health incredibly tasty. And it doesn't have to be a drug either. And it doesn't have to be part of a kind of a destructive culture in which people are kind of using food as a drug. So I love that. That's amazing. So I know this and you know this, but let's just tell people more. Like, how is Belcampo different? I remember having a conversation with you at the Los Angeles store in Santa Monica, You were telling me even just about the grass and how you are feeding the grass that's different. Let's walk people through, like, how is what you are doing in Northern California different than other farms?
So, you know, I think it's important to just explain that there's two radically different ways of feeding beef and ruminants in general. So let's just divide it up. There's ruminants and then there's monogastrics. Ruminants have five stomachs. They're designed to eat a very low nutrient density food, high fiber. You or I, were we to eat grass, we would die quickly, right? We're monogastrics like pigs and chickens. And so we have evolved to eat nutrient dense foods. Cows, on the other hand, have evolved to eat very nutrient, low nutrient density foods, grass. And they process that efficiently in their large multiple stomachs. So if you look at the system that produces most of the beef in America, it's feeding beef on corn and other seeds, and then supplementing that with various foods and non-foods to increase the fiber content. By non-foods, I mean things like plastic shavings and sawdust, which are acceptable additions to cow feed rations in the U.S., along with things like food waste, like candy waste, for example, from manufacturing. So the big divide with our farming and all kind of regenerative and grass-fed and finished farms is that we're actually feeding beef what they evolved to eat and what their digestive system is so obviously designed to eat, which is low nutrient density grasses. Now, in the animal health, right, you have vastly improved health outcomes. Just like for you or me, when we're eating a healthy diet, we have vastly improved health outcomes. So all of a sudden, you or me, when we're eating a healthy diet, we don't need antibiotics very often. We don't get sick very often. I think about it as like, think about it for yourself as saying, well, I'm going to, you know, eat like a bunch of whole foods compared to I'm going to have Walmart deliver a container of Fritos and I'm just going to eat that until I finish. You know, like that's sort of that latter diet is really what the cows are on. It's a highly processed, maladaptive food. So when they're in that situation, they're also on cement, typically in confinement. They have about 15 square feet per animal. They're on a very, you know, the nutrient dense plan puts them through puberty really young. And they'll go, once they develop secondary sexual characteristics, they rapidly can put on weight, just like humans. You go through adolescence, your weight gain potential changes, your musculature changes. And so for beef, they're finished, right? So ready for slaughter at about 16 months. On our system, they're walking around eating grass naturally. And that means that they are taking a lot longer to gain weight, right? And they go through puberty much later and more naturally. Of course, there are a lot of analogies for humans, right? I mean, think about how I know for girls, my pediatrician told me to start looking out for signs of puberty in my daughter who's 7. And I was like, what are you talking about? And she's like, oh yeah, now in the Bay Area, the average age of puberty for African American is like 7 and for white or European American is 8. You know, and I'm like, you gotta be kidding me, right? So, and I asked her, well, how's that changed? She's like, yeah, it's gone like 4 years younger in the course of my lifetime, my doctor's life, my pediatrician's lifetime, right? So this early onset of puberty is something we're seeing in humankind as well. And it's something we actively induce in animals. And it's one of the many kind of like easy connect the dot parallels that you can draw between animal agriculture and human health outcomes, right? Where we get them through puberty faster, we put them on a compressed weight gain schedule. What does that sound like? It sounds like American life, right? So the Belcampo system is more in line with how these animals evolve. They're outside, they're moving around, they're eating natural grasses. The vast majority of American beef is produced in confinement, eating maladaptive diets that make the animals inflamed, sick, and effectively, it's like an obesogenic environment.
And what an interesting parallel with humans. And I think that most listeners will know that the reasons that humans are experiencing puberty earlier is because of all the xenoestrogens in the environment, most likely, whether they're, you know, hormones or whatever in our food. And to say that humans, especially girls, are experiencing puberty 4 years earlier within a single generation is, that's damn scary. There's something going wrong there. And we're just not waking up to the fact that either our water or our food supply or both are literally just riddled with these hormone mimicking compounds that are completely confusing our normal biology. So isn't it interesting that when you feed cows on grass, they also hit puberty later as they're supposed to, and they grow more slowly. And they probably, you know, take a little more time to grow to a finishing space. Now, I just want to paint the picture of a CAFO for people as well, these clustered animal feeding operations. 15 square feet is 5 by 3. That's 5 by 3, which is basically the size of a cow. Like it's not like it's 15 by 15. That's way more than 15 square feet. 5 by 3 is 15 by square feet. So they're basically shoulder to shoulder in these operations. It's not a good thing. The other thing that you pointed out to me at the Santa Monica, restaurant when I was there was that there's this concept of greenwashing, which is something that I also haven't spoken about much on the podcast, but I first heard about from Will Harris at White Oak Pastures. You and I were sort of talking about this as well, that you know of farms that say that they're grass feeding and grass finishing their animals, but in order to do that, they really only have to feed them grass seed at the end, and that you can tell the difference between these two. Can you talk about this?
Yeah. So, I mean, grass feeding is not a regulated set of terms. There are new certifications in the works around this, but nothing that's really achieved any widespread penetration. So first off, on the science about it, I'd say that the biggest important phase for your health in terms of a cow's life is the final 30 days of their life. So when animals are fed on grass their whole lives and then just finished on grain, it takes like less than 10 days of a grain ration to make a very significant change in their omega-3-to-6 ratio. So it's the same thing as you or I. Like if I was eating an amazing healthy diet and then I'm like, but cool, they're just going to like totally fall off the wagon 1 month and eat only McDonald's all day long, I'm not going to look the same on day 30 as I did on day one, right? So there's just these changes in diet have rapid, important impact on their entire fat composition for the animals, just like they would for us. Mm-hmm. So the number one kind of misnomer to watch out for is just grass-fed. Technically, all beef in America have been on grass at some point in their lives. The vast majority are only on grass when they're with their mom. So it's what's called a cow-calf operation, which is the very first phase of a cow's life. And that's when the mom gives birth and then nurses on the calf for somewhere between like 5 and 7 months. And then they're taken to what's called a stocking operation, which is the precursor to a feedlot or fattening operation. So all beef in America are grass-fed at some point. And some unscrupulous operators use that term grass-fed on their beef, or they'll say something like grass-fed and pastured, which may mean at some point. So you have to be really cautious about that type of, just the word grass. That doesn't mean anything. That means pretty much every animal in the U.S. would qualify. Grass finishing is what's truly costly, because getting the animal over that hurdle of final weight gain, which brings an animal to finish, right, to actual nice intramuscular fat and marbling, that's extremely costly, and it's very difficult to do on green grass because you have to have really optimally sweet grass. It has to be high nutrition. You have to have enough grass, right? There's a bunch of limiting factors. So that's where you're going to see more operators taking shortcuts. So I would say the biggest thing to watch out for a consumer is grass-fed and finished. Now, there are other, kind of like hacks and cuts. I haven't seen this with my own eyes, but I've heard of operations using just a sprouted wheat or a sprouted barley and calling it technically grass because it has germinated, so it's technically grass. Now, I don't know how pervasive that is. It seems like it'd be expensive. One that is more pervasive is using a grass seed pellet to finish, which causes pretty rapid weight gain. A grass seed is not that different from a grain. I think it's technically, I don't know the difference there, like biologically, but it's not a meaningful difference. You're not going to get the omega-3-to-6 ratio. You know, omega-6s are a seed fat. Omega-3s are the fat that's found in green plants. So omega-3s are way more expensive to make. Because think about it, if you're trying to like make, you know, any fat out of like anything green in your yard compared to making a fat out of something that's a seed, like I could probably extract fat from most seeds. It'd be very difficult for me to get enough fat out of any grasses and greens. So it just logically, that's a more costly, rarer fat to come across. It's more difficult and expensive for a farmer to connect with it. So that's where there's going to be some shortcutting. I'd say that, you know, the best security for you as a consumer, though, is find a farm, inform yourself, and buy direct. You know, you really can't trust too many middlemen in this, apart from some, like, or if you can't buy direct, look for the certifications, look for the word regenerative, and look for a grass-fed and finished name on it.
Yeah, and I think that's a good distinction. I've been talking so much about omega-6 versus omega-3 fats recently. Mainly, I've been talking about omega-6 fats, specifically linoleic acid. Ruminants have this really interesting part of their biochemistry whereby they can convert omega-6 into saturated fats, so they can actually increase the saturation. They can sort of change the double bonds in the molecules. Monogastric animals don't have the ability to do that, but you're absolutely, I mean, what you're saying is important for the listener to realize that if you are eating an animal that is not grass finished, the omega 3 to 6 ratio is going to be different. I did a couple of videos this past week where I talked about the feeding of rats specifically and how if you overfeed a rat on linoleic acid, which is this omega 6 seed oil that's present in corn, soy, and canola, you can get liver damage in an alcoholic model, but you can abrogate or you can ameliorate that somewhat by feeding the rat with omega-3s in addition. So part of the toxicity of omega-6 in our diet might be an imbalance with omega-3, specifically EPA or DHA. Now, those are going to be in ruminant fats, and we know pretty clearly that when an animal's grass-finished, the real way, their fat is going to have more of these EPA and DHA, and actually DPA as well, which are the omega-3s. So that ratio is important. And I think that there's other things that are beneficial. Like you said, when you're getting an animal that's fed in a CAFO, they're being fed plastic and cookies and candy, and all kinds of things can end up in the fat of those animals. And it sounds like you noticed this personally, and I've heard other people say the same thing. And I've noticed it, at least in my own personal experiments. It just don't feel quite the same when I'm eating, you know, like kind of processed, or not even processed, just not as high quality animal meat. That's why you did this in the first place.
Yeah. And I've done tests on the third, on our competitive set, and I've done tests grabbing meat from reputable natural grocery stores and found that the average is somewhere between like, it's like 1 to 20 of omega-3s to omega-6s in their meats. In Belcampo's meat, we're 1 to 1.2. And I'd say pretty much any regenerative quality farm is going to be like under 1 to 2, you know, maybe 1 to 3, depending on if they're putting in some hay or have a little bit more seed in their natural grass ration. There can be a little bit of variability there. But I was appalled to see samples in my independent testing of up to 1 to 30 of omega-3 to omega-6s, even in products that were labeled as grass. So that's where that's really in that particular test with the really bad results. I mean, I thought about how do I talk about that as my own brand? You know, I don't want to be out there casting aspersions on the competitive set, but I'll just say it to the listeners. Like, there's a deep disincentive for farmers to finish with grass because of the economic, you know, the cost around that. That said, in the past couple of years, I've seen a great improvement in the variety and authenticity of many grass-fed and finished products out there because the market is responding with higher prices for good quality product. So I'd say that it's a brightening field right now. And I do encourage you, I personally, you know, when I first moved back to the US, I gained an enormous amount of weight. I felt incredibly lethargic. I was sick frequently. I had a really bad response to just eating my normal high protein diet with the regular stuff that I found available in the US, which is why I started buying direct and eventually the path that led me to Belcampo. But I do think if you just do the status quo, okay, if you're in your 20s and your metabolism's like a Ferrari, you knock yourself out, you can probably handle it. But once you get into your 30s and 40s and you're more responsive and your inflammatory response is a bit more in, you know, refined and subtle, or perhaps you're like that already, I think once you educate your palate, you notice in your body, you will really see a difference. I've even seen guys, you know, I feel like men tend to kind of get hip to, if they're not like actively interested in this, I see a lot of men getting interested in meat origin, like in their late 40s and 50s, when their metabolism really definitively starts to slow down, and or they start to hear from their doctor about, you know, concerns about heart or being proactive around heart. So a lot of Belcampo inbound customers are like, you know, men in their late 40s. And when I've had a number of interactions with guys who will say, you know, I've been eating tons of meat my whole life and I love it, but I always have this feeling the next day of like, kind of like, ugh, you know, like the sort of gut, I call it like a meat hangover. I feel I can taste it in my mouth the next morning. And when I eat your product, I don't feel that. And so that's even for the person that's not like maybe super in tune with their body or really interested in this. Like I've heard the sort of like circumstantial, very positive report about what it means to eat a clean product for the first time and how you can pick up on that in your body.
And that's such a, that's an important point to highlight. And I think that where I come to with this is like, you can either, I've heard this said in an interesting sort of triangle, you can either have food that's fast or cheap or healthy. Like you can have fast and cheap, but it won't be healthy. You can have healthy and cheap, but it won't be fast. Or you can have fast and healthy, but it won't be cheap. And like, there's like, maybe I'm messing up the triangle, but like really it just comes out of the idea that like you humans just, you can't shortcut this. And you, the, what the animal is eating is so important. And for the animal to have a species appropriate diet is critical for us. And there's, within my communities, sometimes there's a movement just like, just eat meat, don't complicate it. I think you're missing the details here, which are important. And those details are that the quality of the meat matters too. And this is not to be elitist or to prevent people from getting this meat, just to say, hey, you know, like the quality of the meat matters, whether it's chicken or pork or beef. We're talking mostly about beef in this situation, in this conversation, but you know, a species appropriate diet is what you want your animals to be eating.
Well, I would also argue that the rapidity of weight gain is enormously important for the quality of the protein in your body. Awesome. And that, so you mentioned chicken. In our operation, our chickens come to full weight in 8 to 10 weeks. In Tyson, the same breed of chicken takes 2.5 weeks to come to weight. So we're talking about a quarter to a fifth of the time, right, to actually reach a full weight. Now, in 1950, the average life cycle of a chicken to come to full maturity was 54 weeks, so more than a year. So we talk a lot about beef, but beef is really, you know, my life cycle is actually only like 60% shorter than, longer, sorry, than a conventional one. But chicken is where you should be really fucking scared if you're not already, because chicken is literally growing 4 times as fast as it should. 4 times. Like, think about that. I mean, think about it. If your 2-year-old was, you know, 5 feet tall, right? Like, think about what that means, right? It's a terrifying proposition. And I don't think people are cognizant enough. And I can't say, it's not as clear with beef, because beef, it's like this omega-3 to omega-6 ratio. It's really clear, right? There's the science there. With chicken, there's these really disturbing characteristics in fast-going protein that have effectively like these kind of long, ropey muscle fibers. And you've probably tasted them. If you've eaten like a chicken salad in an airport or eaten cheap chicken, you get this kind of like solubility. It's almost like you're chewing a cud after you chew it. And it's like, what are these weird little like granules on my tongue? That's fast growing protein. So I think, and I also just, I get a little woo about this, where I think, you know, these chickens are grown, this massive inflating weight gain. They're in horribly stressed conditions. They're so anxious that they're pecking each other to death. So they cut their beaks off. Otherwise they will kill each other out of anxiety and stress. And I look at like the amount of chicken that women eat in the US and how anxious women are and highly strong and all this kind of like weird energy that people have, you know, in, especially now, I think a lot of it's come to the surface in COVID. But I just think there's just like a sense to me of like, you know, whatever's making those birds so grow so fast and be so puffy, I don't want any part of it in my body. And I don't really need to explain why. Because I think it's just as weird as anything that you might say, which is like, hey, that's so obviously wrong. I don't want to have any part of it. Right? Like, I just think there's something, I don't really need to say there's a huge scientific, you know, data about why this meat that's growing so fast. I think it's the same thing as if you saw, you know, you saw a really, you know, a cow with 5 eyes and said, that's really interesting, but I'd rather not eat that steak. You know, just something that's like so abnormal, 4 to 5 times as fast growing. Here's the other crazy thing. They're not like so we actually use a Cornish cross, which is a Tyson owned genetic. We actually buy our chicks, part of them, not all of them, as do all the regenerative small farms, right? Because there's this one particular chicken that has the conformity, the shape of the body that Americans really like, because that's Tyson's chicken. So all of us smaller farms have had to use that chicken, but we raise it in a much kinder way. And so in the Tyson world, they're still feeding it grain. You know, it's not as, the feed isn't as dirty. So it's like basically it's getting the same type of food, not like with beef where the food type is radically different between my operation. Same category of food, grain. Same exact breed of animal, not a different breed like we've got to, and five times the weight gain in their operation. So I just say, stay the heck away. You know what I mean?
What's the magic there? How are they doing that? They've got to be feeding it to the mutant.
Cortisol, stress, and antibiotics.
Yeah, that's crazy.
When you see on a package hormone-free on chicken, it's actually not permitted by the USDA to use hormones in agriculture for pork or chicken. And it's not because the USDA decided to get really ethical about that. It's because there's been no functional hormones that have been found. We've never found a hormone that's as effective as antibiotics. So antibiotics is a 1.5 multiplier on weight gain. The rest of it is simply cortisol stress.
1.5 multiplier of weight gain. So giving chicken antibiotics makes them gain weight. This goes back to the microbiome. You totally destroy the microbiome. They get fat and unhealthy. Then you're eating that. And you're right, because so many women in America, especially, and now with the plant-based movement, people are thinking, maybe I'll just eat chicken. I heard Kevin Hart on Joe Rogan recently, and he's saying, no, I don't eat that red meat. I eat chicken sometimes. And it's like, oh my God, people just don't understand how misled they've been here. Red meat is the best thing you can possibly eat. That is the meat that he's eating the most species-appropriate diet that it can get. Chicken is one of the most mutant foods out there. I did a whole podcast 2 weeks ago with Nina Teicholz talking about saturated fat. And I titled it, Why Chicken is Killing You and Saturated Fat is Healthy. And I think it's true. And I think that there's so much fear around red meat, which is incorrect. And I unpacked that whole thing with Nina Teicholz. People think chicken is healthy, but it's totally mutant. And I love that you're illustrating why here. Now, here's a question for you that I'm curious about. Have you ever thought about feeding the chickens? Well, I'll ask you what you feed the chickens. And then one of the things I've gotten interested in recently is feeding chickens things other than corn and soy to decrease the amount of linoleic acid in those chickens, like feeding it barley or sour gum or feeding it other things, because the corn-fed chickens do get higher linoleic acid.
Yeah. So we do a soy-free right now. We use a large amount of barley in our feed and we use corn. You know, our chickens are the most out of line with prices in the grocery store. And I now sell a good amount of our products in grocery stores as well. So I have a really hard time already getting consumers to accept the price point of my chicken that's just growing naturally and slowly. So there's a point at which I would love to do a corn-free chicken. And I have in the past. It just, we're talking about the same thing why I did. And I love doing a totally free-range organic rabbit. But it was so expensive, I couldn't really make it work. So in that case, it's purely an economic decision. So if I was to do it, it definitely couldn't be organic certified at that point. You know, chicken and organic is very important for consumers. Consumers care about chicken being organic more than anything else. Don't totally know why. There's some real technical reasons as to the why. Corn is, no surprise, really effective at weight gain. Right. So it's the winner on that front. So that's why I don't do it. I should test for linoleic acid though. And I will, you know, our chickens, especially so if you're interested in a lower linoleic acid, chicken from our company, I would opt for our heritage bird, which is available on our website. It's the one in the red bag that is a much slower growing, even slower growing. It's it takes about 3 to 4 months to come to harvest weight, and it naturally forages a lot. Those eat a lot of bugs, a lot of grasses, a lot of other things. So those are the chickens that I actually use most frequently in my home. They're very lean. They make amazing broth. And literally in my home, when I'm making my broth out of my heritage bird compared to making out of the Cornish bird, I can smell the difference from upstairs because the heritage bird, their bones are stronger. Even though our chicken, our Cornish is also fabulous. And I use it a lot for roasting, you know, it's a different level, a different complexity to it. So it's almost like you can smell the difference in the diet. You know, there's more complexity, there's more richness. They're eating lots of worms. I mean, chickens are carnivores too. They enjoy eating lots of bugs and worms and things like that. And we actually use them in our regenerative system in the cow pastures to help break the parasite cycle. So they'll actually be out there where our cows have grazed and be doing things like eating all the larvae and little bugs and things, which will help, of course, you know, make sure that that next generation of cows that's on that same pasture next year doesn't get hit with any heavy infestation of whatever insects are naturally proliferating there.
And let's go into that, because I think this is one of the details of regenerative systems that people may not be aware of. I talked a little bit about this with Rob Wolf and Diana Rogers, on the last podcast, this idea of biodiversity. And I love this concept of mixing species on regenerative farms. And I think it's something unique that you and other regenerative farms are doing. I've heard of other farms like White Oak putting lamb on the same pasture as beef for the same reason, to interrupt like the brown stomach worm and the barrapole worm, which don't really cross over between those two species. But that's cool with the chickens. It makes sense. It sounds gross to us, kind of like city slickers, like, oh, chickens are eating grubs. But this is the way it's always worked in ecosystems on this planet, that species, when they're together in a space, interrupt the parasitic life cycle of each other. So talk about that, and then maybe talk a little bit about, can you talk about the rotational grazing and even beyond sort of just grass feeding and grass finishing? Like, what does it look like to be regenerative on your farms?
Absolutely. So, I mean, in terms of the parasite cycle, it's just about parasites need a host. Right. And so when you have a bunch of cows in a pasture, let's say there's ticks or some sort of, you know, worm, or that's the problem for them. Once they leave the pasture, they're going to come back. Those parasites will hang out there and wait for their host to come back. If chickens or some other animal that's not a host that also thinks that they're tasty hangs out there, then they will eat all the larvae and you will have a natural way to break that cycle. So it's effectively, it's like the same thing as if, you know, let's say God forbid that your kids were to get whatever, some really virulent thing, you're going to sanitize the heck out of the house in between, right? Or make sure that you get rid of it. Same thing that the chickens do. They just help kind of clean out the natural environment. In terms of the regenerative aspect of what we do, so something I'm really proud of that our farm does is we're documented now by a third party as being carbon impact positive. So we've did our baseline study in 2013 and we revisited it in 2019. And 11 out of the 13 pastures that we had been actively tracking had a significant increase in soil carbon. So the land that we started farming really in 2012 was effectively fairly impoverished land. We, with the farming operation, rotational grazing, and primarily cattle, but you know, in total, about a dozen different types of livestock, commercial livestock, we've increased the carbon density of the soil in our area. So we've increased the actual carry. I'm going to have my son be quiet.
Anya's doing a little bit of home management.
I didn't tee this one up as well. I've gotten really casual about things. So that's the major, the piece about regenerative from our operations. It isn't just something I'm saying. I actually have the data that we have effectively sequestered literally millions of pounds of carbon on our farm by farming it with livestock. So I think that's a huge, you know, the question is sort of how we do it. It's really simple. We have perennial grasses, so we do not till the soil. We do not use any interruption in the soil. So the soil is never cut. There's no leakage of carbon. And there's a really rich and dense ecosystem of roots. In perennial grass lands like ours, the root systems are over 30 feet deep. The grass might never be more than 11 inches, but 30 feet below the soil. When you till, you don't develop that. So perennial pastures regenerate because they have deep root systems that add organic matter to the soil and actively put carbon into the soil. The other thing we do is the animals poop, that drops seeds and fertilizer. They're spread out, they're extensive, as the opposite of intensive, like CAFOs that you mentioned. That's an intensive system. Our system is an extensive system. So the animals being spread out very, very far apart, dropping their manure, which is rich in seeds, helps regenerate and also adds nitrogen in a healthy, expansive way back to the soil.
Yeah, I love it. And I talked about all this on the podcast with Rob and Diana, this kind of idea of returning carbon to the soil as the root systems become more robust, sequestering the carbon that's gathered from the environment via photosynthesis, and then back into the roots, back into the mycorrhizal networks. This soil microbiome is really what it's all about. And, you know, I was talking to my friend Anthony Gustin today, and we were both agreeing that we are just soil alarmists. We're just soil focused, and soil's not sexy. We just need to make soil sexy again, because when soil becomes sexy, if you use soil as the metric, it's very clear that ruminants are good for the planet, and monocrop agriculture that makes the majority of plants that people are eating, including all the plants that go into Beyond Burger and Impossible Burger, which are trying to eliminate animals from this planet, that's completely bad for the soil. So if you use the soil carbon, if you use the soil microbiome as your metric, it's black and white what we should be doing here, what we've always done with diverse ecosystems. So I want to show people a couple of pictures of your farm from the website. I love this. So this is Mount Shasta. Is this you, Anya?
Yeah, it is.
That's amazing.
I love my job every day.
That's amazing. So you guys can see this is Mount Shasta. This is one of Bel Campo's farms. And again, here you guys are. You got some good photos going on here. And this is cool because you guys partner with farms. You make them humane, pasture-raised, regenerative. There's a video here. And then you can actually see the farms that Bel Campo sources from, which are pretty cool and kind of a rare thing for people to show this. And you can know where all this is happening. And in the summer, you guys actually have, are you guys going to, I guess you can't do meat camp this year, can you?
Well, and I want to call out too, those are, that's our new partner farm program. So that's the expansion of our network. But currently most of our product is still from our own farm too. Okay. So just listeners know that partner farm is something that we're just doing now to expand and grow it without growing just endless amounts of acreage. And also I think, you know, the opportunity to be a marketing arm for the very best regenerative farmers and bring people down the path of regenerative ag is amazing. But still right now it's mostly actually from where those pictures are, where we have a 3,000 head herd of beef, about 2,000 pigs and lamb each, and we produce about 60,000 chickens a year. So those are all on our own operation.
How many acres is the main operation?
It's just under 30,000.
30,000, which is a lot of acres, you guys. It's big. So
all down when we, and then we also lease some land north and south as well. Uh-huh. So
you can shoot a bow really far on 30,000 acres. Before the podcast, Anya and I were comparing our yards, and I said, I've got this really cool house in Austin where I can shoot my bow 50 yards. Anya goes, well, that's cool. I live in Berkeley, and I've got a yard where I can shoot my bow 40 yards. And I was like, wow, that's awesome. That's amazing. And I thought, oh, 30,000 acres. We could shoot a bow really far.
You should come. We can shoot there. This summer we're just on the precipice probably of canceling the August event, sadly. But it's just in terms of the managing the expectations, et cetera, it's too much for me to handle. But you know, we are renting actually, we do what's called Hip Camp. You know, Hip Camp, the website, it's basically private landowners can rent really dope campsites directly to consumers.
Cool.
And if you go to Hip Camp and look for Bel Campo for like $100, you can stay on our farm. So anybody, and we actually, it's really cool. We have fire pits there. We have a little farm store so you can buy all the meats and hang out and do, and Shasta, the area is so amazing. It's like incredible water, incredible fishing, incredible hiking. It's just gorgeous. And it's just very, very pure and clean up there. So if you're looking for a getaway and you're based in California or somewhere on the West Coast, you could easily just drive there and rent a Hip Camp, one of our locations, for a couple of days. Yeah, we're not doing as many. I mean, we canceled all the spring camps. I'm hoping that I can hit them again in September. But I don't know. I mean, it seems like a moving target right now. So we're really being cautious about things, simply because of the, you know, the liability. I might have my own views on the contagion, et cetera, but from a business perspective, the liability components of us are just a little too risky.
It's complicated. Okay, cool. So being a culinary wizard, like you are, what's the woman, culinary witch. That sounds worse. Culinary warlock.
I'll just move on.
Being good at culinary things.
Since you enjoy cooking.
what are some, people always ask me this, and how do you like to do some organ meats? Like, give us some ideas for how you incorporate organ meats. When I've come to Bel Campo, you've just cooked me liver, and when you cook it, it's amazing. You can just pan fry it, and it's good. But like, how do you like to get organ meats into your diet and your kids' diets? Just let's give the listeners some basics to start from.
Okay, so for organ meats, my starting set would absolutely be poultry organs. And I think you can buy them now on our website. But liver, I'd start anybody who's starting their journey with organ meats on chicken liver. And chicken liver, I simply slice the lobes with a set of kitchen shears. So remove the connective tissue from the two lobes of the liver. And I'll heat some ghee or suet to the smoke point in a wok and stir fry them with some pink salt and call it done. And I try to take all my liver. My goal in life is just to cook the meat to optimal deliciousness, you know, and not try to cook to like a food safety standard, which is mostly about killing pathogens that shouldn't be there anyways.
In the first place.
Right. So, you know, my goal is like encourage your listeners, buy meat that's pathogen free and cook it till it's yummy. don't buy meat that might be dirty and cook it till everything might be dead, which is what the USDA wants you to do. So I cook my liver usually medium rare. So it's pink in the middle. I serve my liver either with a squeeze of lemon or with creme fraiche, which I loved for some acid. And then to bump up the, when I'm doing carnivore and in general with my meat diet, I have a harder time sometimes getting enough fat. And so I love to do creme fraiche together with the liver as a combination. So I would just do a pan seared medium rare, serve it with a dollop of creme fraiche or sour cream, and you're set. My go-to for beef liver is to pan and lamb liver is to thin slices, pan fry it. Again, the technique, it's always just about getting a nice medium rare on it. That's really the best way. And then also just make sure, you know, liver, you get clean sources. It's going to be much less of a chance of kind of any acrid flavors or ammoniac flavors. And then also make sure that it's very fresh. You know, I get the question a lot about, hey, can you tell from the color, et cetera? Educate your nose and just smell it deeply. It should smell like an organ, sort of minerally, a little dark and clammy. That's how I describe the smell, but it should smell clean, right? Any smells that are off or acrid or eggy, that's I would stay away from. Another key thing with liver is make sure that it's fairly dry, because that'll get a nicer sear on it. For the fat for cooking liver, I love ghee. I actually avoid avocado oil now lately. I've just been using my ghee and my rendered suet to cook. For heart, I had this for dinner last night. My very favorite way to prepare heart is I make anticuchos, which I'll make a marinade that's mostly cumin, a mild chili pepper, and oil. I use suet for that as well, for the oil, garlic, and oregano in that, and marinate it. And I'll keep it in my fridge for a couple days that way, and then fry up the individual chunks. So it's like a nice, heavy kind of like crust. Marinade crust on the heart chunks. I have a recipe for that on my personal Instagram feed on Anya Fernald, and that's an IGTV recipe, but that's a delicious dish, just an anticucho, traditional spice crusted one. If you want to use no spices, I would simply cut it very, very thin. The heart is really interesting because there's so many muscles going every which way in the heart that you don't have to be worried about cutting it for tenderness. You can pretty much slice it any way. It's kind of like an avocado, like there's compared to slicing an orange, right? Where you can just cut into any way and it's going to be okay, regardless of the meridian alignment. So with your heart, you can just kind of cut slices of it, cut them thin, sear them, and you're good to go. I also recommend considering like an after marinade with the heart. Do a nice medium rare on it and then toss it with a chimichurri or a yummy marinade afterwards. I do the same approach with a lamb heart. And then with chicken hearts, I eat those all the time, just deep. Like I do a really hearty amount of like of ghee or suet, and then I'll do a stir fry on my chicken hearts.
What keep about like, it,
do not overcook them. So
yeah. What about sweetbreads? How do people make sweetbreads?
So I got to work on a sweetbread recipe that's a bit more approachable because my recipe is pretty hardcore and that takes a long time. It's so delicious though. Do a low wood fire. So I cook a wood fire down to embers and then I put them on for 3 hours over embers.
And sweetbreads, just so people know, is it thymus? Is it also pancreas? Is it a combination of both?
It's a thymus gland.
Just it can thymus.
Be, yeah, it depends on your source. There are people that put other glands in there as well. Mm-hmm. We simply do the thymus. The more correct one is to call it the thymus. I think there's some of the traditional sort of broader categories had both in it. For us, it's a thymus. Very, very nutritionally dense, high in fat.
Amazing.
Freaking delicious. One of those meats that you can actually just feel in your body when you eat it. You know, you're like really, really invigorated by that. You don't need a lot. But yeah, I'll just do a low and slow over the open fire. I'm sure you could do the same thing on a Traeger. Put it at like a 220 on a Traeger for 4 hours. I do not poach it or do any of that prep work. I simply dry salt it, trim any blood spots from the glands, and then just throw it on the grill. And then salt it and slice it thin. And I drench it in lemon juice just to kind of balance some of that. The more there's some flavors in the thymus that are like slightly eggy and intense, delicious, but the lemon and some citrus or acid on it, sherry vinegar is another way to dress that to kind of counterbalance that.
Do you ever do anything like spleen? Do you have any spleen recipes?
Oh, I do not have any spleen recipes. I could get my hands on some spleen, but I don't cook it too often. You know, with any of those organs, you know, you can pretty much just cut off any of the connective tissue, right? That's going to just be texturally unpleasant. If you really want to conserve it, put it into your broth pot and render it into collagen for your broth. But I would typically just sear it in ghee, salt it pretty heavily, and go for like a medium or a medium rare. I would then slice it thin and toss it with an acid. That's kind of how I'm going to kind of cook any kind of unknown organ. I don't cook a lot of kidneys either, but that's sort of how I'd handle them as well. You know, there's also some really neat recipes that I come across with, like, you can grind those into a blend of with a ground beef as well, and make them into patties, make them into meatloaf, and a number of other things like that if you wanted to.
Awesome. And you've done some carnivore experiments, right? Are you doing a carnivore diet right now? I know you've had a couple of weeks of carnivore.
Yeah, I am. I do. I've been on carnivore now for about 3 weeks. I want to try it out again. I did it at the end of last year. Really like it. I have my cheats of, I do eat a lot of olive oil and lemon juice when I'm on carnivore, just because I like those flavors, and I'm too much of a sensualist to give up on the stuff that I think is really yummy. But yeah, the biggest innovation from my current carnivore experiment has been, I started making pemmican. And honestly, it kind of sucked initially because raw suet's not very delicious, you know, like just cold suet. I know that you're more hardcore than me, so you probably think it's bomb. But like for me, I'm like, it's that the solubility, the melting point is just a little too high. So I don't like the residual stickiness on my palate. So what I did, and I'm making this again tonight because I finished all of this that I made, and it's so freaking delicious. I take a whole chuck and I do a low dry in my oven. So I dry it at about 110 degrees overnight in my oven. And then I grind it, which is the typical first step for pemmican, no salt on it. And then, so I make a very fine meat powder, dried meat powder. Then I melt a really high quality cultured butter and mix it with the meat powder and store that in the freezer. So I make like a pemmican, but instead of using suet for it, I use butter mm-hmm. as a snack food. That is incredible. And I put a little bit of pink salt on it, and that's just absolutely my jam. So I think this time I've cracked the nut a little bit more with carnivore, because I found something that's like I can eat at my desk, a little bit more snacky, you know, that I can have when I'm on carnivore.
Yeah, that like that candle wax mouthfeel of suet is the stearic acid, which is something that I've gotten really interested in recently, because that 18 carbon saturated fat has really powerful effects in the human body. So I think figuring out how to get more stearic acid in our diet could be very helpful metabolically for a lot of people.
Well, I now cook exclusively with it. Yes. did it kind of on a lark, because my buddy who I'm doing carnivore with, Mike Salemi, I was, you know, he was interested in, he's just trying out different types of fat. So I rendered some suet for him. And I just had a ton of jars of it around, and oh my gosh, it's changed my cooking life, because I no longer have any issues with any high heat oils. I love ghee, but it's, you know, $30 a jar. It's expensive, good quality ghee. Suet, I can render out, you know, a quart of it for like $7 or Del Campo prices, you know, like good quality suet. And it's delicious. You know, the smell is very, but so I use it exclusively now in my anything that's warm. So I'm now consuming a lot of it. But when they eat cold out of the fridge in pemmican format, that's a little bit harder.
A little tough.
I love the combination of suet for cooking chicken, and for making braises and things. I cooked kofta in it the other day. It's a beautiful brown, like it really browns nicely. It's great for cooking eggs. So I'm actually going to do a video on rendering your own suet, and I'm putting it on the website now too. Just whole suet, for people who want to eat it raw, and then also just to be able to cook with it. Cause I think it's a transformational fat to have in your kitchen. Holds at room temperature, inexpensive, great for your health. You feel amazing. Like an amazing smoke point. The smoke point's like over 500, right? So it's really fabulous. It's the cheapest, highest quality, unrefined cooking oil you can possibly have.
And it's very high in stearic acid. So go get it, you guys. You're going to sell out of this one, Anya. Like, awesome. That's, I mean, I'm on a mission to make suet just like more approachable for people. It is waxy, but if you're going to heat it, it's absolutely the best thing to be using for your cooking.
I made the best chicken tacos chicken taco filling with it, with actually just, you know, I had poached chicken, then I seared it in the suet and then braised it with some bone broth. And that suet, it just added that, you know, chicken, the lack of fat, it's a little boring, right? But then adding in a nice finishing amount of suet was so delicious. Other thing I've been playing around with that your listeners might get a kick out of culinarily on the carnivore front is taking inexpensive cuts of meat like chuck and sirloin tip, and searing them and canning them in bone broth. Mm-hmm. So that's been something that's been a fabulous addition for my carnivore journey. Has been just like, I pressure can it for an hour and a half in my pressure canner, and the meat becomes incredibly tender, and it's a snackable item that's pre-cooked, and it's shelf stable. You know, it's canned. It can last for 2 years. So you can add spices and things to that as well, but that's been a great hack for me to have some readily available meats like that.
I just think that the chuck roast and the stew meat, I mean, before we jumped on this call, I had dinner at 2:30 in the afternoon, which is that's my MO these days. And it was Belcampo stew meat that I cooked I just kind of like blanched it in bone broth. And so nothing like the culinary, creations that Anya might make, but I think it's really easy. I just take bone broth, I blanch stew meat. It's very good. It's really enjoyable meat.
First.
I just blanch it. I'm kind of a savage anyway. You know, I'm like Mowgli.
How long do you cook it for?
What's that?
How long do you cook it for?
Less than a minute. It's basically raw.
Oh, I get it. So you really are just like basically making like a shabu shabu kind of like.
Yeah.
Like, do you slice it thin or do you in chunks?
I slice it thin, but still there's plenty of it that's really raw in there. So, but I just love that I can just easily cook this in bone broth and I'll drink the bone broth. And it's this very, very high quality, very affordable meat. You know, sometimes the pushback that I get when I talk about the carnivore diet and how I eat it is I can't eat ribeye every day. It's too expensive. And I say, yeah, there's plenty of other cuts out there, sirloin, chuck roast, stew meat that are very affordable, that are very high quality.
Ribeyes and New York's, I mean, it's less than 10% of the animal.
Exactly.
I mean, and a lot of people are spending a lot of money on collagen powder these days, and stew meat has all the collagen you need.
Exactly. Built in. It's perfect. I love it.
I mean, that's like where I get all my collagen naturally. I do think that there's just a greater absorption when you're getting it from your natural foods.
Oh, absolutely.
The more that you eat that's from these kind of muscles, which is, you know, all of our stew meats from these muscles here, the shoulders, a lot of mobility, where there's a lot of mobility in the animal and joint potential there, you're going to get tons more collagen because there's just lots more sheets and small muscles that need to move and joints and ligaments and tendons and things. So you're going to be able to hit all of your collagen goals just naturally by eating things like stew meat.
I love it. I know you got to go. Just two more quick questions and I'll let you go within 90 seconds, bonus round. So I got a question from one of my listeners about this and I thought you'd be a perfect person to ask. It's a woman and she's saying, how do you deal with the stigma of being a woman that eats red meat with fervor? Any thoughts on this? I mean, I'm sure I have a lot of women listening to this and I think that red meat gets stigmatized and, you know, you're a woman in the space. How do you deal with this?
Huh?
Carnivore woman.
I don't know. I mean, let's see. And by the way, I've renamed my diet low plant.
Okay. Carnivore-ish.
The low plant diet.
I like it.
I don't know if I have a feeling of stigma about eating red meat. I think I come in with, to interactions where people understand, you know, what I do for a living. So I don't know.
Not quite the same. It's not quite the same.
It's a little bit odd. You know, I'm not like at an event where people are surprised if I'm eating a lot of red meat. But, you know, I had an interesting conversation yesterday with a really young woman who, you know, was talking to me. She's a vegetarian now. It's a consultant we're looking at working with. And I just gave her some stats about how important it is for your fertility to eat red meat. And, you know, just little things that I think are surprising for women to learn that, you know, if you stop eating meat as a woman when you're 10 and you become pregnant in your 30s, your fetus will contain essential amino acids from the meat that you ate in your childhood. So your body held on to that for you. So think about the importance. That's something that's very well documented. Another really interesting thing, again, around fertility and health is that your access in the maternal diet to DHAs and essential amino acids that only come from meat is a better indicator of your child's performance on standardized tests than your country's economic index. That's a study out of UCSB. So if your access to high quality animal protein is a better predictor of your kid's health than the wealth of the country that kid is raised in. Yeah. It's like, think about that veganism twice there. That's a study. It's like, it's more important than if you're in whatever Eritrea or Sweden is whether or not you're getting healthy animal fats for your kid's brain. That's massively important. The other thing to think about is like, you know, your fetus's bones, their first reason we get bone collagen from bones and extracted through bone broth is because in your fetus, your baby's bones are first formed as a matrix of collagen that then calcifies, right? So just like in terms of maternal health and female health, these are enormously important things that you need to be cautious about. So I think for, especially for young women, especially with the academic of infertility and issues now, I just think it's very, be very, very cautious about your decisions in terms of renouncing animal protein. But the great thing that I, the biggest answer I think to me is I'm 45. I typically people, they'll ask me about what I'm doing and like what supplements I take, and I really don't take anything. You know, it's just for me, I think the way that you show up in the world is like when you're eating a very high animal diet, it's a, you project in a lot of vitality and energy from those food sources. So, I get the question a lot about like, what do I do to my skin? And I literally use no skin products. And I did in the past. I used to have very dry skin when I was a vegetarian. I had horribly dry skin and dandruff and all those kind of things that happen when you have dry skin. And the thing that fixed it, and it's my skincare regime to this day, is to eat a ton of animal fat. And it works out. So I was, that's probably an answer to your question, but those are like my thing. It's like, if it's a young woman, I say, do it now or get ready for your IVF later. And then also just in terms of like, I think for women too, it's enormously important to look at like the angle of like how you show up in the world and how you look, and you can't do a better thing for your hair, skin and nails than eat animal protein.
That's amazing. All right. So the last question I always ask people, I'm curious for your answer on this, is what is the most radical thing that you have done recently? And then we'll let you go.
The most radical thing I've done recently.
This is like 80s radical, like cool, like exciting.
Oh, I get it. Oh, wow. Let me think for a second. I mean, I canned elk the other day. That was really fun. Probably the most fun that I had recently was I spent a day sitting in a river on Saturday.
That sounds amazing. Which river?
The American River. I love rivers, and that's been the blessing of COVID is like, when you don't travel all the time for work, all of a sudden on a Saturday, you're like, fuck yeah, I'm going to get outside. And, just going and sitting in a river and feeling the water, the energy of the water coming over you. And just, it was amazing. Such a good day. And I brought an egg salad with me. That was so good. I'm making this salad. I call it my 14 egg salad, where I boil a dozen eggs and then I make a mayonnaise out of two eggs with olive oil. So damn good. So it was like a good picnic and a good
Did you eat 14 eggs?
I didn't eat them all. No, it was a group, but still it's like the perfect ratio was a dozen eggs and then two yolks. Like, here's my 14 egg salad. I think in a day I could probably eat the whole thing.
I bet you could. I could eat 14 eggs in a day.
I bet you do. Right after you boil some stew meat, but I want to make a stew with you. I want to show you how to do the braise.
Let's do it. Where can people find more of your stuff? And then, we will say goodbye.
So culinary content for me is at Anya Fernald, my Instagram account. And then Belcampo to buy our meats is at belcampo.com. We've been putting a lot of energy onto, our offerings for carnivore and keto on our website. So if you check on soon, we're going to have a really great range of portioned organ meats. We have suet. I think we have over 50 products now on the site. Every type of meat. I want to create the best damn virtual butcher shop there. And it's exciting for me with COVID that people are ready to buy online, trying out meat online for the first time. So it's an exciting moment for us, but I really am thankful too for you spreading the word, Paul, and getting people to pay attention to where the meat comes from. It's more important. And then I think people even understand at this point, and the science is just now starting to kind of come out about it.
Super important. Thank you for the work that you're doing, Anya. Thanks for coming on the show. And I can't wait to make some stew with you soon.
Okay, I'm ready. Just have your day. Okay, bye.
All right, that was the podcast with Anya. Amazing woman. Totally appreciate and in awe of the work that she's doing to bring us all such better food from these amazing farms in Northern California. Once they open up, I would encourage you to go visit them. It's a really cool spot, and I want to go to meat camp and stay at one of their cool eco tents and just be up there in that environment. So, what's new with me? Well, this is a Friday bonus podcast, so I'm working on getting ready the podcast for next week, which is Tuesday, working on other exciting business projects. If you don't sign up for my newsletter, what are you doing? Go to my website, carnivoremd.com. It comes out on Sunday. If you're hearing this podcast on Friday or Saturday, you still got time. I'm going to release the podcast on Sunday. and you will not, I'm released that, sorry, the newsletter on Sunday, you won't miss it. But please check out my book, thecarnivorecodebook.com. And if you guys need a CGM, the folks at NutriSense are the way to go with that. NutriSense.io is an amazing group of people, and I will be doing much more about that in the near future. My dad is going to get a CGM, and we're going to talk about it. So, thecarnivorecodebook.com. Check out my friends at NutriSense. Check out Belcampo. Carnivore MD will get you some, I think it's 20% off Belcampo. It's a really good deal on stew meat, organs, whatever you want. Get a ribeye. It's really good stuff. So let me know what you guys think, and I will talk to you soon. Stay radical!